Hi folks, welcome to Epochs of the Lotus Eaters 104, I believe it is, and this is part 4 of our series on the Assyrians. I'm chatting to Bo about the fall of Mordor. I expect in this episode we'll get to the very end of the Assyrian Empire. But where were we last time? Sennacherib, wasn't it?
Yeah, going to try to. So we got up to the death of Sennacherib, great sort of biblical Sennacherib. One of my favourites, I'd say. But we've said a few times before about the story of the Assyrian Empire. It's sort of...
Sorry, it's fun, everybody. One of my favourites is Sennacherib, the guy who destroyed all of these things.
Again, it's like having a favourite World War I battle, say.
It's like, it's like having a favourite dictator.
Yeah, you know? It's not exactly because you love it. You think it's great, but it's just the one...
It's a fascinating character.
Right, it's most interesting. Yeah. But we said before that this story of the Assyrian Empire, it's sort of, if it was plotted on a graph, it keeps rising right till the very end and then falls off a cliff.
Yeah.
So the last sort of two main Assyrian kings that we're going to talk about, the son of Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, and then his son, Ashurbanipal, who you can easily make the argument is sort of the greatest one.
Mm.
And there are two more kings after him before the fall of Nineveh, but it's just the whole thing's falling apart very, very, very quickly. No one remembers, I'll tell you their names, but no one particularly remembers their name.
What was the last Western Roman Emperor, Romulus or Augustulus?
Well, again, as you can argue, can't you, which one's, like, but there's many different ones. Romulus or Augustulus, possibly.
It's that kind of thing, though, where it's like, it's a 12-year-old boy on a crumbled empire. This is over.
And it's sort of taken death wounds years and years and years before.
Yeah.
It's just like the final coup de grace.
Yeah.
It's sort of inevitable sort of thing. That's what happens. But we'll get into all of that. So, the reigns of Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal to do in this one. So two big, important kings. Mm. I think it's very, very interesting.
Mm.
I think lots of family strife. That's really what the story is.
Mm.
I think maybe history and the fate of the Assyrian Empire could have been completely different if there wasn't this internal strife, inter-family strife there. So, all right, so last time, if you remember, or if you've just watched it, if you're watching this weeks or months or years from now, Sennacherib was killed by his own sons.
In a temple.
Yeah. we think almost certainly whilst praying or in a temple or something.
It's the most heretical thing you could have done.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, it's so totally beyond the pale that it's Esarhaddon that's the sort of one good son, really, isn't he?
Yeah.
So I'm not having that.
So what had happened is Sennacherib had many sons, at least five surviving sons, and he'd made the eldest one sort of crown prince or something, and then changed his mind for whatever reason, decided that that eldest son, Esarhaddon-Sumi, he decided he was going to sort of dispossess him and give it to the youngest son, Esarhaddon. And the oldest brother, all the older brothers, were not happy with that. Mm. And so we know there's some sort of, not exactly civil war. Well, nearly a civil war.
I think, you could call it a civil war, I think.
It doesn't quite come to a battle, full battle, but it very nearly does.
Yeah.
Either way, there's sort of lots and lots of factional strife in Nineveh, this is, because Sennacherib favoured Nineveh. Had his capital Nineveh.
As I recall, it's something like the older brothers, who are obviously bad eggs, even by Assyrian standards, essentially slandered Esarhaddon, and he had to flee to the west or something. And he gathered an army. They gathered an army. But as they are heretical patricides, and he wasn't, He was able to essentially do a Sulla and just be like, look, I'm obviously the right person to join. Come over to me.
Mm.
And the army defects to him. And that's all.
Pretty much it.
Right, okay.
The only thing I think that was slightly incorrect there was that I believe Esarhaddon fled east.
Oh, did he?
But all the rest of that, exactly right.
Yeah.
It happens quite a lot in history. The thing that springs to my mind is the Wars of the Roses. Loads of times two armies will line up.
Mm.
And then there will be like some sort of parlay between the top brass, but all the normal men sort of make up their mind. Like, no one really wants a battle usually.
Yeah.
The normal people, the normal soldiers will sort of make decisions on if they're going to defect or not.
Yeah, this happens a bunch of times actually.
And then there'll be some sort of critical mass where everyone just for whatever reason, sort of confidence, a bit like on a stock market, there's some sort of confidence game going on.
Mm.
And people think, oh, one side is just going to win, so I'm not going to bother fighting for the losing side. So I'm either going to completely desert or just go over to them. There's no battle.
In this particular case, it seems to be a moral question. Actually, Saradon, he was made the crown prince by Sennacherib. These guys did murder the king. Mm. Are we fighting for them, actually?
Yeah.
You know, actually, no. And then you get other ones like with Pyrrhus, where the Macedonian army defects to him. It's based on his charisma and, you know, glory. But then you've got like Sulla as well, which again was kind of a moral issue as well. It's like, no, I'm going to come back and fix Rome. Come on over. But there are loads of times, like I said, I can think of like three off the top of my head where this happens. And it is a fascinating and highly dramatic thing, because we are talking about tens of thousands of men who are ranged against each other. And then something happens and this tidal shift happens. And then the leaders of the opposition, Sennacherib's older sons, they realize their position is gone.
Yeah.
They don't have a position anymore. You know,
their men under them are like, are we the baddies? It's funny you should mention it.
The great conquering Sennacherib, and we're fighting for his murderers. You know, the disinherited murderers. What are we doing? You know, does Asher look favorably upon this course of action? Probably not.
It's interesting you should mention Pyrrhus, but it happens a fair bit in the wars of the Diadochi, the successors of Alexander.
Oh, yes.
Where they'll just switch sides. I think it happens a lot more, where it does happen a lot more in civil wars, civil strife, because if you're fighting for your homeland and your family, then you're much less likely to do it.
Yeah.
But if it's just, we've got different ruling families over my country.
Where it's purely political.
You're right.
Right?
Yeah.
Because with the Diadochi, with Pyrrhus, with the War of the Roses, with Sulla, Esarhaddon, these things are purely political. This is not, as you say, you know, the Germans aren't invading and, you know.
And so that's when, again, it springs to my mind, the Augustus and Mark Antony civil wars.
Mm.
Again, you can just sort of, you're probably... There's a propaganda war. There's a whole propaganda side to it.
Yeah.
Of the appearances really matter, rather than just who's strongest in the field. You've actually got to make an argument why you're the best, why people should come over to you.
Yeah.
And we are told that those older brothers, quote, they went mad and they drew their swords inside the city of Nineveh.
Oh, really?
And started, slandering the young Esarhaddon, obviously calling him, you know, that he's the usurper or something. If you're going to play a propaganda war, you obviously just sling as much crap at your enemy as you possibly can, right?
But it obviously wasn't very effective.
Yeah.
The king did name me. You did murder him.
Hmm.
Like you've got a really weak hand here. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So Sennacherib fled.
Esarhaddon.
Esarhaddon.
Sennacherib.
Oh, no, yeah, sorry. No, Sennacherib's dead. Esarhaddon fled east.
Not fleeing anywhere.
He raises an army
somehow.
It's great in this stuff in history. It's frustrating, annoying, and great that you don't really know any of the detail of that. He just raised an army.
This happens all the time as well. And I just really want to know. Just as a quick aside here, I always want to know the details. Like, does he just, with a handful of men, wander up to a village and go, right, I need soldiers? Who are you? Why? Oh, I guess we're coming then. You know, and then suddenly he's got 20,000 men. It's like, how did that happen? I really wish we had more information on how in the ancient world they raised armies. Because it just happens all the time.
Mm.
Oh, you raised an army. Don't just say it like it's Rome total war. You know, how did that happen?
Yeah.
What did he say to persuade them to come with him? Where did he get the arms from? Where's the logistics being organized? It drives me crazy. That's just this one line. But there must have been so much work.
It's not like Civ, where the city just builds new units.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like that, yeah. The only thing I could say on that is, because obviously we don't know, the Assyrian Empire, even by this point, and we're still talking the 700s BC, sorry, 600s or late 600s BC, would still have been quite a sophisticated bureaucracy, quite a sophisticated beast, where there'll be all sorts of things in place for raising men and making arms and armour and all sorts of things.
Mm.
It's not sort of ancient Sumer anymore.
Mm.
It's, as we've said before in the previous ones, it's more sophisticated than, in some senses, in centuries and centuries and centuries later.
Mm.
So... Esarhaddon, I suppose, as as you know, we still would have been famous as one of the great princes.
Yeah.
Under Sennacherib.
So did he go to some bureaucrats?
He would have had a name, you know, the name recognition sort of thing.
But did he go to bureaucrats in, like, you know, an Assyrian outpost somewhere in Babylonia and said, right, okay, you know, whatever troops are on the rolls here, send them to me? I mean, I assume that's what he did, but we just don't know, you know.
Right. Well, whatever happened, he raised an army, he comes back to Nineveh. Apparently the two armies and the older brothers raise an army of their own. Mm. They come out onto the plain in front of Nineveh, like they, you know, in battle array, and so they're going to throw down, and it just doesn't happen. All the other side just sort of defect, well, that's it. That's the ball game, really, because then Esarhaddon is able to enter victoriously in Nineveh, sort of unopposed.
Well, the brothers literally have no way of resisting him now.
Yeah, the undisputed champ. And Esarhaddon, as you can imagine, I mean, his father's the king of Assyria was murdered.
The great king as well.
One of the greatest there's been so far. Yeah. One of the greatest figures in ancient history, in all of history, still, you can say. I mean, use the word great in inverted commas, but, you know.
Well, use the word great to mean large and expansive.
Right, yeah.
Not good or fantastic.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Which is usually how the great is actually used.
And of course, Esarhaddon himself had been in mortal danger. I'm sure if his older brothers had got him, they would have chopped him up.
Entirely. Right? Yeah.
And so, in true Assyrian style, he doesn't spare the rod, should we say? I mean, his wrath, his vengeance is something to behold. He kills them all and all their families, like their whole family. Like, and there will be his
nephews,
nieces, and nephews, and aunties, and all sorts of things. He just kills them all. This is the thing, actually, a bit later in history, in Persian history, and the Parthians as well, I believe, did this. Quite often when a new king came in, he would kill all his brothers. Yeah. Also the Ottomans, I think, did stuff like that. We're just going to clear the board.
But the Machiavelli makes a very fine point on this. You have to root out the entire line of the enemy, or the rival prince, or else he becomes a bulwark around which resistance and civil war grows.
Yeah, so, if you and your whole family are mental barbarians, yeah, that's the case.
Well,
the Habsburgs didn't really need to do that, didn't they? The Windsors don't require that, do they?
Sure, but what happened to the princes in the tower? I mean,
it
does happen.
It does happen.
And it happens for a reason, because this is what, when you have dynastic politics like this, you have people who are loyal to that family and they won't abandon their loyalty. And any people that you harm or offend on the way to your ascent, use them as a rallying point to gather around. And suddenly you might have like 10,000 men around someone who also has a claim to the throne you sit on. And so I'm not saying it's not barbaric. I am saying it is a necessary and well understood, even in ancient times, part of royal politics. I'm not saying it's good.
Yeah. The Princes in the Tower is a brilliant riposte there.
Sorry.
No, it's great. That's a really good example.
Didn't mean to.
No, it's great. It's a great counterpoint. Yeah. But, you know, it is.
You
still
are right about barbarians.
Yeah, yeah.
It is, like, it is barbarous.
So, for example, if you go back to Henry II, where there was boys there, wasn't there? The Richard the Lionheart and John and that Geoffrey. They could have, you might have argued, would sort of kill each other, but they didn't. They were a bit more
Christian,
civilized, chivalrous. Like, well, Richard, by rights, probably should have murdered John. If we're going by this standard, I mean. He would have. Machiavelli would have said, just bump him off real quick. It's the best thing for you to do. But he didn't.
Well, absolutely. But I think that I'd put that down to them being Christians.
Okay.
Machiavelli was an outcast intellectually in his own time because of his very pagan position on that.
Well, Richard III was a Christian. He murdered his nephews in the tower, though.
Not saying they're all good Christians.
Okay, yeah.
You know? But the general sort of sway towards loving one's fellow man and treating life as sacred that underpins Christianity, probably I would have, that would be my argument, is it why this happened less in Europe. But I mean, pre-Christian times it happened all the time, and in non-Christian places it happened all the time, and because it's a very sensible thing to do if you're Esarhaddon.
Yeah, yeah. as I say, just sort of clear the board.
Yes.
Just do away with everyone. Well, maybe a bit like in a lion's pride, when a new alpha takes over, he usually just kills all the babies of the previous alpha.
Yeah.
Just kills them all out of hand.
Yeah.
Any new babies are going to be mine. That's it. Simple as that.
Yeah.
None others. Can't stomach any others.
But it's important to point out that that creates a kind of weakness in your governing structure. Because if you're, say, you know, 1,000 miles away in Egypt, sacking Memphis, and some barbarians on your eastern flank start attacking, well, usually you would have had one of your brothers or an aunt or an uncle or some extended family member that you could have trusted with an army to raise that army and resist them. But of course, if you've killed all of them, then it's just you. Hmm. So you better be everywhere all at once.
Yeah. And even if you have loads of sons, well, Henry II's another good example. Hmm. Well, just because you've got loads of your own sons, it doesn't mean they're not going to rebel against you, though, still.
Yeah.
Yeah. William the Conqueror, his eldest son, sort of constantly rebelling against him.
Yeah.
In the end, all of Henry Plantagenet, Henry II's sons, rose against him in the end.
I mean, look at Sennacherib's sons.
Right.
They might end up murdering you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
It's not unheard of.
Yeah.
It doesn't guarantee.
No, it doesn't.
Just because all the claimants to the throne are your progeny doesn't guarantee they're not going to be absolutely ruthless still.
No.
So, anyway, Esarhaddon is now the reigning, defending, undisputed king of Assyria.
Sole member of the royal family of Assyria, practically.
Yeah. He's a very, very strong ruler.
Mm-hmm.
But he's interesting because we get a bit more than some of the earlier or middle Assyrian kings are sort of fairly two-dimensional a bit, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because all we've got quite often, we've only got fragments of their sort of victory steeline thing. So they come across to us as fairly two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Whereas Esarhaddon, we've got a bit more, he's fleshed out a bit more. We know a bit more about him and Ashurbanipal.
He seems quite a sympathetic character, actually.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah.
If you can ever say that about an Assyrian king.
Right, yeah, as far as Assyrian kings go.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
He doesn't seem like a total monster.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though he's just murdered his entire extended family. So,
although he does do one or two genocides. So
but
he does raise to the ground one or two.
Which
really
Assyrian
cities.
King doesn't do this?
Yeah,
you know, but we've got some of his letters and that, haven't we?
Mm.
So you can get an insight into the workings of mind. He's not just an insane tyrant. He's insecure in his power is basically the problem.
One thing to say, that murder of Sennacherib apparently sent shockwaves basically across the whole region or the whole world.
I bet it did.
Because it's just so it's like a president being murdered, or the head of China or Russia being assassinated.
Yeah.
Sort of the whole world suddenly is like, oh wow, that just happened.
Yeah.
What now, kind of thing.
Yeah.
What next?
And that doesn't happen either. Like I mean, which other Assyrian king got murdered by his own sons?
I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Exactly.
I mean, we don't know the fates of many of them.
Sure, but like
we don't know how Ashurbanipal died, but
if they'd been murdered by their sons,
not famously,
it probably would have been written down. So yeah, the Assyrian king just doesn't get killed like that, basically.
Yeah,
a lot of them die of old age.
Yeah, a fair few of them. Surprisingly, a lot of them.
Yeah, right. Which is weird considering what they spend their lives doing.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I don't know why I've got Henry II on my mind, but another thing swings to mind about that. So there's a great line in A Lion in Winter, a great film, everyone should watch that, where Henry says, if you want to be a king, 50, and alive all at once, you have to be a schemer.
Mm.
There's no other way around it. Like if you're sort of naive or anything, you're not going to get very far. For so many Assyrian kings to have died in their beds of old age, or at least apparently, they seem to have been good at they knew their business.
They must have had the fingers on the pulse.
Right, I think a lot of them, again, like lots of like Persian rulers and things, you would have probably been raised in a milieu which sort of fired you, you know, into being the type that can handle it once you get to the top, that top post.
You would have known all of your life that there's a good chance you're going to be thrust directly into the spotlight at some point. You would have had advisors and tutors and older family members, assuming you weren't related to Esaradon, who would have been advising you and guiding you your whole life.
Mm. Yeah. So, but one of the things that seems to characterise Esarhaddon and his reign is that he was, and you can't really blame him, was paranoid.
Yep.
Extremely paranoid. It's a horrible way to live. Mm. I can only imagine. I don't live in fear or paranoia.
No.
But, you know, the tiny amounts I have had in my life at various points.
Yeah.
Horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Now, imagine that you're at the very, very pinnacle of a death empire that rules literally only by terror. And imagine how much more magnified that paranoia becomes.
Yeah. Like I say, maybe at school or something, you know, there's some kid out to get you at some point or something like that to live with it for a while. And you're only really staring down the barrel of, at worst, having to have a fight that you may or may not even lose.
Yeah, exactly.
But knowing that there's dozens, hundreds, maybe whole people's worth of people out there that would kill you if they could. There are assassins out there.
It's not just there are assassins. There are great powers around that want you dead. There are possibly remnants of your family that want you dead. Who knows what, like, weird priesthood has in store. You have got... It's a horrible position that Esaradon is in.
So if you look back, his father was obviously murdered, assassinated, and his grandfather, Sargon II, was killed either in battle or in some sort of ambush.
Yeah.
May have been betrayed for that ambush to come off, who knows? But both his father and grandfather came to sticky ends, and he sort of sees that, and he's just aware that he's in a precarious situation, sitting at the very tippy top of the mountain like that. You know that... There are enemies that would do you wrong if they could.
Desperately trying to climb the ziggurat,
as it were, yeah. And he's a very superstitious, well, I mean, everyone in, it seems pretty much everyone in that world was superstitious.
Yeah, because he's got loads of soothsayers that are constantly sending him letters of reassurance.
And a lot of those survive, so we know.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of them survive. And so it's actually kind of adorable in a way, where it's just like, you know, I saw a bird flying. What does this mean? And they're like, oh, that's actually good news, sire, because that means that you're going to be victorious in battle or some nonsense like that. It's like, right, okay.
Yeah, lots of magic spells and things, incantations and things to try and keep him safe. And we'll get onto it towards the end of his life, but it gets to sort of crazy lengths by the end.
Yeah,
people get, like we did in epochs about the first emperor of China, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
And the great lengths he would go to try and become immortal or even just extend his life.
Yeah,
when you become desperate. So he decides to not really spend most of his time in Nineveh. Apparently, it seems he must have calculated it was a bit too dangerous there. There's a particular keep that's like an impenetrable type keep that he keeps himself sort of cooped up in.
And it's
he
only
likes
got,
to stay there.
It's only got one exit, hasn't it? You know, that was a. I watched a documentary about this a while ago where apparently it was literally so he could monitor who's coming in and out all the time. So that is paranoid.
There's certain places in the medieval and ancient world where they were just considered impregnable.
Yeah.
Like the
Crank the Chevalier.
Yeah, right. Or the keep at Ravenna. It was just because of topography, just because of geography, the way it is, it's just sort of impossible to assail that particular keep.
Yeah.
Or you can defend it. There's loads of times, even in sort of the 18th and 19th century, even in Napoleonic times, they would say things like 200 guys could defend this position from a whole army corps.
Yeah.
It's just that perfect for defensive purposes.
We should do an epoch about this, how geography is a force multiplier at some point, because it is just staggering how important geography is in war.
Particularly before gunpowder.
Yes.
Like it's not so much the case during by Napoleon's time because
artillery
pieces can pound down stuff. Yeah. But in the pre-gunpowder world, quite often. So anyway, there's a particular keep which he keeps himself holed up in, and he's very paranoid. It's sad, really. But you know, he also had that experience of his own brothers, going for him. So his relationship with Babylon, there's always the perennial
relationship
Babylon
with
question.
The gap, the big sandy wasteland that is Babylon.
Right. So, because his father, Sennacherib, had
destroyed it.
Absolutely destroyed it. Apparently, you know, even tried to, or did destroy like the foundations of it and inundated it, diverted the river to sort of flood it. So there's like nothing left, nothing. That's what the inscriptions say.
God, I love the Assyrian summit. I'm just so tired of this. All of it gone. All of it.
Yeah. It's funny.
The river over the top of it. It's just...
It's funny, in the epochs I did with Josh about A Bridge Too Far and Operation Market Garden, where the Allies liberated Holland, the Queen of Holland said, after we'd liberated Holland, here's your country back. She said, destroy all the royal palaces. There's been Nazis in them. I shan't sit in them ever again. Destroy all of the royal palaces. And the people around her, including the Crown Prince, was like, no.
I don't think we'll do that.
Yeah, shut up. That'd be stupid. But in the Assyrian kings could say something like that, and it may well get done.
It'll just happen. It'd
actually, like destroy that entire city to the foundations.
Now there's 100,000 men who are going to do exactly what you just said, to the letter.
We're actually going to do it. Yeah. But anyway, so for whatever reason, we don't have all the details perfectly, but Esarhaddon decided he liked Babylon. Yeah. So his grandfather, Sargon II, had been a great fan of Babylon and Marduk, you know, a Babylonophile.
Yep.
And so it seems that Esarhaddon was as well.
Yeah.
So he wants to start rebuilding it. It was a massive rebuilding project. He says, I want it because they knew sort of the dimensions and the plans of Babylon. They knew them exactly. So he orders it to be rebuilt exactly. They say not an inch bigger or smaller on anything. Rebuild it exactly.
Which is amazing, really, isn't it? Like, I mean, there's an argument that this is done to curry favor with the people of Babylonia, which is the entire sort of southern province at this point, which undoubtedly it was very popular with them. You know, we've got letters where they say, brilliant, thanks a lot. We really appreciate that, you know? And so it seems to be, like, this is why I was saying that Esarhaddon is somewhat more sympathetic than the other Assyrian kings. Like, he's actually building something rather than just tearing everything else down. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, that seems to be a bit of public outreach.
Yeah, and it's that age-old decision when you conquer a people's. Are you going to grind them under your jackboot forever? Or are you going to assimilate with them in some way and go native on some level? You know, like, so Alexander decides to go a bit native, doesn't he? The Macedonians get a bit annoyed with him that he starts wearing Persian dress and taking a Persian-ish wife. And
I mean,
all that
I'm on the Macedonian side on that. Right. What are you, gay?
Declaring himself a god and that they should prostrate themselves before him and stuff. It's very un-Greek, that, very un-Macedonian. But so it seems that Esarhaddon chooses the policy to be sort of kind to Babylon rather than keep grinding them down. It is probably the smarter thing to do, isn't it?
There's nothing left to grind down.
Well, there's still the people. Zenakrib didn't annihilate every single person in Babylonia. So he decides to rebuild it, and we're told sort of does so as best possible, sort of exactly. That's how he deals with the Babylon question.
But this is now the classical Babylon that the Greeks end up walking into.
Nearly.
Is it?
Yeah. Get into that in a minute.
So
that's in about 680, we're told. Again, BC, obviously. In 671, he goes on campaign into Egypt.
Oh, really? Does he treat Memphis the same way?
Yeah.
I rebuild Babylon and I level Memphis.
Yeah. Well, we're told of Memphis. There's an inscription that says, Memphis, his royal city, he's been the pharaoh, his royal city, in half a day, with mines, tunnels, assaults, I besieged, I captured, I destroyed, I devastated, I burnt with fire.
I love that it's just, I'm the clement Assyrian king. I'm going to rebuild Babylon. I'm going to, you know, bring justice to my murdered father. But the second it's dealing with anything warlike, so, well, yeah, I mean, obviously I devastated, I destroyed, I burned with fire. It's like a pit bull. Yeah. He just, you know, oh, he's such a nice boy, but, you know, like, you can't help it.
Yeah. It's funny, I like pitties. They're actually really, really cute. But sometimes, obviously, something evil in their mind clicks and they're in kill mode.
Yeah.
Not all. A lot of pit bulls are extremely nice. Anyway, I don't want to talk about dogs.
I'm racist against pit bulls.
Yeah, yeah. They can also, obviously.
Yeah, they're evil. I really think so.
Depends how they're raised. Well, it does.
So does the Syrian kings, but look at what's happening to Memphis.
Not all pit bulls will kill anything they can. Let's put it that way.
Disagree.
All right. he went into kill mode when he came to Memphis. And it's really sad because Memphis is, well, not sad. I mean, it depends.
Well, it's doubtless sad if you're an Egyptian.
I mean, Memphis was a great city, one of their capitals at different points. Mm. The amazing archaeology at Memphis.
A beautiful, ancient, venerable, royal city. And the Syrian king comes along and says, I don't like this. Not having that.
So he, in this period, in the last few generations of the Assyrians, they do sort of waylaced to Egypt a number of times.
Yeah.
And well, this is one of them in 671.
Oh, maybe if the Egyptians weren't constantly meddling in Assyrian affairs.
Unfortunately, it does seem, well, it runs in the family, the Sargonid kings of Assyria. It seems like some sort of mental health issues or depression, really. It's very, very, very hard, almost impossible to diagnose any of this stuff, certainly. Well, impossible to diagnose it, certainly. It's very, very hard to do it for people in sort of the 18th, 19th century. Mm. Was that guy suffering from mental health issues or not? Mm. So in the ancient Assyrian world, we don't know. But it looks like that. Again, we've got all sorts of letters between him and his family, in him and his doctors, court doctors and things. And they say... It's talking about melancholy. Again, it's a translation thing. Some sort of depression. Because Sennacherib, we think, also suffered from something like that. After he first destroyed Babylon, it sort of maybe sickened him on some sort of deep, deep level. Mm. And he sort of became a bit more introverted after that. You know, it was like too much even for him or something. Anyway, as I had on, seems like he's suffering from depression. We got some descriptions of his illness and things. It's not very nice. We don't know. Well, his queen died of natural causes. And that seems to have sent him into sort of a blacker mood. You know, black. Everything's black. Quite often, it's obvious to say really, but when you're very, very close to your spouse and as you get older... When one of you passes away, the other one sort of, it really takes the wind out of their sails. Bismarck said that when in his 70s, he said, and they said, are you going to retire or anything like that? And he said, oh, no, I'm good to go. Obviously, I've got a lot less energy. But if and when the wife dies, I don't want to stick around. So that's the thing. And anyway, Esarhaddon's wife dies, the queen dies, and it seems that sort of,
This is the thing that crops up a lot throughout history as well, where you've got a particular couple and they just seem very devoted to each other. It's actually very nice and romantic, you know, even if you're a genocidal Assyrian king. You know,
and if you've been married for decades and decades and decades, you're sort of almost one person on some level. You're sort of, you really, really do depend on them sort of emotionally or intellectually or even in terms of policy sometimes if you're sort of a power couple like that. You're sort of a symbiotic relationship. And when one of you goes, it's sort of half of you has gone with them. And it's very difficult to come back from that. Certainly if you're like in your 60s or 70s or 80s or something, it's like sort of a mortal blow in some ways.
And you're already suffering from mental health problems and you're already paranoid and you're already highly superstitious. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. He was already predisposed towards sort of depression or something. Well, we're told, but he does want to eke out his life as much as possible, though, because he does this thing that's interesting. And again, the first king of the first emperor of China did something very similar. It's interesting to note that this goes across all different cultures, is that they thought you could sort of fool the gods into putting all the bad juju on someone else.
Yeah.
And that it would... you could escape all the bad things that are sort of that you're fated to suffer. So you have a fake king, basically a fake emperor. The real king would go off in disguise and go and live as a peasant or something in disguise somewhere else, and a completely alien person
a total random commoner.
A changeling
yeah.
will come in and live as the king, live in his palace, wear the royal clothing, the royal garb, and eat the royal meals and all that sort of thing, wear the jewels. And then after 100 days, when the gods and the demons and the universe has put all the bad fates on him, all the bad juju, you then kill him. And the real king can come back and start reigning again. Again, with something like a clean slate, something like that. To us, it's absolute complete childish and almost insane nonsense. But you can see the reasoning in their world, in their worldview.
Yeah.
So Esarhaddon did this three times.
It's bad luck, isn't it? Because you're right, you've been chosen by the king. Why? To do what? To become the king. Oh, that's brilliant. For 100 days. And what happens then? You get killed. Oh.
I wonder if the person, the Mark,
yeah.
knows or not. I suspect they probably do. I suspect maybe even they're willing.
Yeah.
Maybe. It was like be an honour to do this for the emperor. I don't know.
I wonder about this because like, you know, like sort of Aztec sacrifices and stuff like that, where it's like, you know, you this is a divine favour that is falling upon you. Your soul benefits in some way in the afterlife, doubtless, you know, things like this. There's doubtless a lot of religiosity surrounding this ritual. So, yeah, it could well be that people volunteered for it.
How could the person not know something was amiss, though, as well, right? Yeah, well, you're just going to make me...
The king?
The king out of nowhere for no good reason.
It can't have been ignorance.
It's like that Eddie Murphy film, Changing Places.
He's
very suspicious. Why are you just giving me all this massive house and all this great job and loads of money?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm sure that they would have known.
Yeah, I suspect they would have. Yeah. Maybe even there is an honour to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Deeply suspicious culture, remember?
Yeah.
Superstitious culture.
We're told that even though he does this three times, he's still just sort of filled with doom. Again, I'm blessed not to really suffer from any sort of, you know, mental health issues or sort of this incurable feeling of pessimism or something.
Impending destruction.
Yeah, yeah.
This is something I'm surprised that all Assyrian kings don't feel, though, because you must understand that, like, the entire world is ranged against you. Like, everyone hates Assyria.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.